Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Yuri Geller about his secret life, and we're going to continue the conversation now, get into some more interesting aspects of course, what was covered in the documentary, but hopefully some of the other stuff here as well. Now, before we carry on that, then let me just ask you a little bit how it works for you, or what you feel on your end, I guess. I mean, there are certain examples in the movie where you, for example, you found oil for one of the Mexican companies. You're locating, balls from these cans, water, different items that is hidden. This was stuff you did with the SRI and everything. What do you actually experience on your end? How does this work for you, Yuri?
Very simple. When I do a drawing, when you think of a picture in your mind, or when you draw something, or a good example was when Kid Green, who actually gave a brilliant quote on the cover of The Secret Life of Uri Geller, Kid Green said, "In my experiments, Uri was superb, astonishing, a superstar," and this comes from Dr. Kid Green, former CIA assistant national intelligence officer. He was in Langley, CIA headquarters, and I was in California with Putoff, and he said to me, "Okay, Uri," because they said they don't. He said he doesn't believe that I can see where he is or what he's holding. And I held up a book, opened it on a page, and what I do is I visualize in my mind an imaginary television screen into which I have to see what he's holding or what he's thinking. And in that case, I saw scrambled eggs, and I saw the word very clearly, architecture. Or architectural, I can't remember what I've written across the page in Palo Alto. And that's how I saw it on my imaginary screen. That's how I do it. And obviously I was right. It was a few thousands of miles away. This is 40 years ago. No telephones, no internet, no Skype. So there was no way of me seeing what he was holding. Now, when I do the dowsing, I'd simply kind of lift my hand over the maps when I found this huge oil field, offshore oil for Pemex. Pemex is a national oil company of Mexico. I just feel almost like a magnetic pull. My hand is pulled towards the map. My finger is pulled towards a precise point, and I pull out my marker. Those times I don't think Sharpie existed, but today I use Sharpies, and I put a little X. And I know that it's there. Either the oil is there, or the gold is there, or the mineral, whatever I'm looking for, or whatever in terms of intelligence. Then it could be a platoon of tanks, aircraft, nuclear weapons, etc.
Now, there's a lot to this, of course. I wanted to ask a little bit more about remote viewing. Is it you were part of that very, very early on in that when that program developed at SRI? Was it, you who helped to spearhead how that came into fruition at the time, or were the other people already kind of doing this type of work at that point? Do you know?
I will change those words. No, I don't think I was a spearhead, but I think that I started it off, the remote viewing. Maybe they already toyed with it, but then suddenly I come in and I read the minds of the scientists. I read the secret drawings and envelope, and then they give me a task, which is actually not in the documentary, is that they feed, I believe, a computer, a dictionary, and the computer chooses a drawing, and I read the mind of the computer. And the computer chose a kite, and I drew a kite with a tail and ribbons. So you understand, that kind of freaks them out. And then they say, Kid Green says, "Here are a few millions of dollars, start this research." And I guess that's how remote viewing was born. I was doing already remote viewing 3 years before that in Israel. But I didn't know. I didn't call it remote viewing.
Of course.
It's like when, Carl Jung coined up the word synchronicity. Like, I'm talking to you now, Henrik, because this is all synchronized in the universe. I'm not talking to you because of a coincidental introduction to you. Of course not. This was already planned, mapped out somewhere, synchronicity, synchronized in the universe beyond us. So I've done remote viewing, except in Israel they didn't call it remote viewing. They gave it some Israeli name, and I was doing it alone. There was no other Uri Gellers, and there were not sophisticated computers. There was nothing like that then.
You did work both for the Mossad and for the United States CIA, correct?
I would say yes.
And were there any at some point here where these conflicted as in relation to what you were tasked to do but by either of these?
I don't understand your question.
Was there something, I mean, okay, let me rephrase that. In the documentary, we can see some interesting information coming out through some of the people involved in SRI. They know it, you know, they were funded by the CIA, etc. But they say in the documentary that after you left, they started looking for microphones. They started looking for things way you could tricked them and everything. They were afraid that you were still working for the Mossad when you were there, correct?
Oh, absolutely. That's correct. They thought that I was a double agent.
Yeah.
And they thought that, I was, I don't know, you heard what Pal says, that I was kind of, they instilled in me things that they've never, the Americans never seen, and they created a superman, a super spy, and I was there actually to derive and extract information out of the scientists and the CIA. So yes, they did tear up, I understand, the laboratories and looked for hidden microphones and so on. So I loved that because, again, I was living the spy movies. I was living James Bond. I was doing real work, amazing work, and yet I was an entertainer. Then I was, doing my big television shows and interviews and stage shows worldwide. And this is an interesting story to bring in the controversy, until the day I was invited onto the Johnny Carson show. And I didn't realize that I was walking into a trap, because Johnny knew James Randi, and they kind of rigged it up, or they set it up, or whatever. The atmosphere was terrible. I sat there for 22 minutes humiliated, and I thought, that's the end of Uri Geller. Go back to Israel. Pack up and go back. And let me just complete this interesting story. I went back to the hotel, devastated, drained out, fell on the bed, fell asleep, and the next morning the phone rings and the operator says to me, Mr. Geller, I have a Merv Griffin on the line for you. And I said, you mean the Merv Griffin? And she said, that's what he says? He says that's he is Merv Griffin. So I pick up the phone and I said, hello. And it was Merv Griffin. And Merv says to me, Uri Geller, I've seen you on Johnny Carson last night. I want you on my show this week. And that's when it dawned on me, Henrik, that there's no such thing as bad publicity. You see, the skeptics, most of them, didn't know about PR. They didn't understand what publicity is all about. And I knew it. I am a master publicist. And I'm telling this to you shamelessly. I'm one of the kings of PR in this world, because I knew very cleverly, very shrewdly, how to take the controversy, what the skeptics threw at me, twist it, churn it, mold it, and tailor it to boost my career. And you actually have to send all these skeptics bouquets of flowers, because they're the ones that wove and created the myth of Uri Geller, the legendary, the mystique, the mysteriousness around me. Without them, I would be just another nobody.
Now, let me ask you this. Are you always employed, Uri, or do people who want to have you for their tasks call you in for specific tasks and that's it, kind of thing?
I don't think I have a comment on that, but I can tell you that just to finish the skeptics, I needed the skeptics. I needed the camouflage. I needed to do my work quietly and secretly and confidentially. And I needed the world to say, is Uri Geller real or is he not? Because I need that space. To answer your last question, I need that space to, yes, receive those coded red phone calls that periodically do come in.
And there's two aspects to you, and you mentioned that quite, openly in the documentary, that you have the entertainer part and then you have the secret spy part, if you will. But I'll be honest with you, I feel that the two are very intricately connected. And I think that the camouflage that you mentioned, that outer inbuilt safety device, as you mentioned in the documentary, that, you know, hey, I'm just an entertainer, has opened some doors for you, Yuri. And this is and this is maybe where you're doing some of your more important work. Any comments on that?
Of course it opens doors. Are you kidding me? I mean, one of my last tasks was, we're talking about international relationships and Palestinians and Israelis, I was asked by the Israelis to get the Israeli Red Cross, who are actually called Magen David Adom, into the International Red Cross. And with parallel with that, to get the Palestinians into the Red Cross. They are called the Red Crescent, because they couldn't do it. So I had gone on this 3-year trip with Condoleezza Rice, the president of Switzerland, the head of the Red Cross in America, Bonnie McLevin Hunter, the head of the Red Cross in Geneva. And it took me time to materialize the agreement for them, for both of these international, you know, important agencies to sign. Humanitarian agencies, obviously. And I believe they signed because of my entertainment value that I brought in. And I'll tell you exactly what happened. The Israelis were sitting on one side of the table, the Palestinians on the other. They were arguing and shouting, and I was just sitting on the side. And then I looked at Micheline Talmeret, who later became the president of Switzerland. And obviously she saw me in her childhood on television in Switzerland. And I said to her, Micheline, can you tell the waiter to bring a spoon? And she smiled, and she told the waiter to do so. So the waiter comes in with a silver tray, and on the silver tray was a big spoon. So I pick the spoon up, and I say to him, look, everybody, stop, look at this. And I started stroking the spoon, and, you know, the spoon obviously started bending. And then I handed it into the hands of the Palestinian, the head negotiator of the Red Crescent. And the damn spoon continued bending. That totally freaked them out. And they signed the agreement. And today, the Palestinian Red Crescent and the Israeli Magen David Adom have been accepted into the International Red Cross. So that is just one little story out of quite a few that I managed to pull off, not because I was working for the Mossad or the CIA, but because I managed to, I don't know, ignite my charisma, my personality, and my character, and with a freaky spoon bending act, and make them sign different agreements.
That's all it takes, huh? A little spoon bending. So how do you do that anyway? How do you bend the spoons?
And look, please forgive me to everyone listening. I beg you, don't think that I'm trying to show off or glorify Uri Geller. I'm really not. I've done that. I was a show off when I was young. Of course I was. You know, I wanted to be Elvis Presley of the psychic world.
It's still a little bit there. It is still a little bit there, right?
Yeah, I guess so. This is why I wanted to meet Elvis. And this is why I bent a spoon for him. And he gave me a few spoons. And the John Lennons and the Elton John. Because I love that world. I came from nothing, Henrik. My mother was a waitress. She was a seamstress. She used to take me to the flea market and buy parachutes, old American parachutes, for which she would cut out and sew dresses. We had nothing in our house. And that was the instigator. That was a catalyst that made me want the fame and fortune. I wanted to buy my mother that television. I wanted her to stop working. So I was totally mind blown by the fact that I met John Lennon and Elvis and all those amazing celebrities at that time. So I circulated around them. They freaked out for my talents because they were great singers, they were great actors, they were great sports people, but they couldn't bend a spoon. And I could. And I will tell you how I do it in a moment. But what I'm so amazed and astonished is what I said before. How on earth did I manage to instill spoon bending into world culture, where movies like Woody Allen in Annie Hall mentions me. Just recently, what's his name, in Red Lights, Robert De Niro, played me in a major motion picture. Bands mention me in their songs like Incubus and so on and so on and so on and so on. So for me, I say to myself, my goodness, out of Little Israel, a spoon-bending act turns into an iconic spoon-bending act. And I respect every magician out there. I respect every illusionist, every mentalist that managed to copy my act. Most of them do it better than I do it. And that's basically what I did. Now, how do I do it? This is where I love to draw the fire. This is what infuriates some magicians and some mentalists and some illusionists. It infuriates them. It gets them angry that with my Israeli chutzpah, I dare to say that what I do is real. When I bend a spoon, I bend it with the power of my mind. And do you know why I say this, Enrique?
No.
Because I do it real. Because it's real.
All right. Now, maybe we could talk, well, maybe we can't talk about it, but I want to ask you nonetheless what kind of other work you did for the Mossad. There are a couple of interesting things in the video regarding disabling radar functionality during Operation Entebbe. There's a number of these things that has been suggested and everything like that. Is there anything of these that you could mention or talk about or give hints about what kind of things you actually worked on?
Well, all these things are actually said in the documentary, but not by me. So I cannot comment on these things, especially things that I've done for the Mossad are a no-no. And that's basically what I can say. There is another interesting revelation that really came out from Jimmy Carter's mouth. He shouldn't have said it, but it is in the documentary when a Russian plane, top secret Russian plane with top secret codes, crashed in Zaire. It went straight under the jungle canopy. Now, those times, the satellites could not detect or photograph anything under canopies and clouds. Today we can do that. And President Carter was lecturing in a university. This is after his presidency. And a student got up and asked him, did anything weird or bizarre happen while you were president? And he said, oh, yeah, some psychics found this top secret Russian plane for us psychically. By the way, Henrik, do you realize that what I'm telling you now and what you're telling me is being recorded by the National Security Agency?
Well, of
maybe
course.
By a few others.
Sure.
Do you realize, you people out there who are listening to us, most of us have mobile phones. Well, just so you understand, the mobile phone that you own, whether it's a BlackBerry or an iPhone or a Samsung number 3, or any mobile phone that you carry with you, is an open microphone to the enemy. So I advise you strongly, because maybe some businessmen are listening to us, if you want to make sure that nobody is eavesdropping on a business meeting that you're conducting, tell everyone to leave their phones, their cellular phones, outside. And then you close the door, because your phones can be activated, the cameras can be activated, the movie cameras can be activated. A lot of people tell me by email, oh, but we close the phone.
That doesn't matter. No.
Today, Henrik, I focus more on positivity. I'm a positive thinker. I'm an optimist. When I get about 300 emails a day. When I get an email from teenagers telling me, oh, Mr. Geller, asking me, can you teach us how to bend a spoon? My response to them back is this, and I answer most of my emails, by the way. I have no managers, I have no secretaries, I have no agents, I have no PR people, I have no image makers. I don't have those, I don't need those. But I answer my emails, and when I get such an email, I answer the kids back this way. I tell them, forget spoon bending. Instead, focus on school, create a target goal to go to university, become a positive thinker, never ever smoke, never ever touch drugs, and think of success.
Let me ask you this now. I wanted to run some more, shall we say, current geopolitical things by you as well here, or what's been going on in the bigger arena lately. Have you helped to find people that have gone not only missing per se, but people that are that other instances or nations in some cases are looking for to people who've gone missing one thing example, it might be just taken out of the blue here, but are you aware of anybody who's helped, for example, locating Saddam Hussein after he was found in his underground shelter back in 2003, or Osama bin Laden, or anybody of that nature?
Henrik, would you be very kind? I don't know if you wrote it down or you memorized it, but would you be very kind to repeat what Scott Jones said?
Which
find it in your notes. Which Vikram asks him.
Yeah, about
if this is still going on.
Right.
Do you remember what Scott Jones said?
Sure. He said that it's gone black, and he said that his logic to, well, the question was this: why would the military or anybody who has an advantage when it comes to finding people or tracking things remotely or whatever, why would they shut down a program of that immense magnitude and prospect? And of course, his answer was that, I can't answer that, but I think your logic is powerful. Of course they wouldn't. It would have gone black. And that's where it left off,
And that's my answer to you for this question that you just asked me.
Okay. Now, yeah,
let me put it this way. Wouldn't any intelligence agency of a big country, say Germany, America, England, Russia, Israel, Japan, China, wouldn't they go for people who have certain abilities, the power of the mind, or psychics, or intuitives, or remote viewers? Of course they would. The work of an intelligence agency is to look for everything, anytime, everywhere. They don't care how the information is manifested as long as they get the right information. And that's exactly what happened after the 11th of September, the tragic attack in New York. America, if you remember my words, needed information, and they needed information fast. So every big intelligence agency around the world probably has an arm. They call it in different names, but that arm employs people, individuals who are intuitives, who do all kinds of mind power missions for them.
Now, I thought it was interesting as well that, I think the international relations, a lot of the things that we see on the TV at the end of the day, are kind of, from my point of view, theatrics, actually. There is always a much more deeper, interesting story going on behind the scenes. What's told in the media is very much on a need-to-know basis for the people who are involved in that. But I got interested, and my interest got piqued after 9/11 was brought up in the documentary as well, as it was kind of a suggestion that a lot of remote viewers and other people overall with psychic abilities were activated after this point. But as a psychic, you have to know that there was something wrong with the official 9/11 story, right?
Well, I don't, Henrik, really buy into the conspiracy theorists. If you're alluding or you're kind of telling me that, someone else did it, is that what you mean, or what do you mean? Tell me in words.
Certainly, there are certainly a lot of different theories out there, but my point is that if one begins to examine the official, you know, commission story, you pretty quick realize that there's something that's not quite right. Now, I'm not saying
What is it, Enrique? I'm asking you now a very clear question. What is not right? Tell it to me in words.
For example, the 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 have been found alive. This was reported by the BBC. Building 7 went down. You know, before and was reported by the BBC as well before it actually
went
down.
So what are you concluding here? That who is responsible for that attack? I'm not saying that you might believe that, but what are you telling me?
Well, that's my question. See, I'm trying to wrap it in that kind of context that I don't know that. I just know that something is very fishy with certain data that we've been given about the story.
Well, that it's rubbish. They were terrorist radicals who wanted to kill Americans, and they flew the planes into the World Trade Center. Full stop. That's exactly what happened. And I do follow sometimes the theory, you know, hunters and conspiracy theorists from the Bush stuff. And I see it, but it's nonsense. This is very clear cut, clean, and was understood very, very quickly. Where they went wrong, the certain intelligence agencies, and believe me, or certain individuals were warning of an imminent attack, but there was not enough technology available, or they were listening to other dirty talk, to other noise that was going on at that time on computers and telephones, and they missed this focal point of catching these murderers. So that was, a big mistake, tragic thing, and it happened. But so my answer is I don't believe all these stories that some other people are responsible for that attack. You know, you mentioned international intrigues and so on. One of my other missions was a very positive one, to influence the Russians to sign the Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty. And it was arranged by Senator Claiborne Pell, who was then the head of the American Foreign Relations Committee, who sent Ambassador Max Kempelman, who was a very important and influential figure in Washington. He actually got the President's Star, I think, by either Clinton or Reagan. Max flew into London to brief me. And I knew that no one will ever believe that this is happening, so I had my brother-in-law photograph us meeting secretly. And the task was to fly to Geneva with them, and Al Gore was there with me too. And my task was to simply bombard Yuli Voronsov's mind, who was the head of the Russian negotiator, to sign their nuclear arms reduction treaty. So I managed to get behind Yuli Voronsov and get really close to his head. I was maybe 4 or 5 inches away. And I started psychically, telepathically bombarding his mind, sign, 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 sign. And this is in the documentary, and they actually signed. And of course, I can't totally sit here and claim and tell you that it happened totally because of me, but there's no doubt that I was influential telepathically in convincing him to sign the nuclear treaty.
Do you have to be close to the target? This could not be done remotely? Okay. Do you know why
I do. I've been asked and still being asked to influence certain individuals remotely, but that's much more difficult. I don't know really why. Maybe it's a psychological angle. Maybe my whatever is leaving my mind, call it vibration, call it frequency, call it wave, call it telepathy. I don't know what it is, but maybe by being close to my target, that target receives the instructions much clearer and faster than me being, say, 3,000 miles away from them.
Well, I think it's very interesting because it shows as well what the intelligence services are willing to do, at what lengths they're willing to go to be able to influence. I think that works on multiple different levels. Do you know if there has been other people like yourselves that have been part of some of these type of objects or operations as well, Yuri?
I do know, but it's they're doing it. Do you know why? Because it's cheap. It's not it's not, you know, satellites. It doesn't entail bringing, you know, that today the intelligence world uses so many different tools, from satellites to, gosh, to little things that, I won't go there now, but all this costs money, you know, billions, billions, not tens, hundreds of billions of dollars are pumped into espionage. And when you have people who are intuitives, all you have to do is get them a room, get them a set of computers, and tell them, go to work. So to fly me to Geneva, what's the big deal? I don't charge for this. I do it out of my ideological belief systems and reasons and love for my country. I remember when they took me to brief in some top intelligence agents and military officials, they used, they asked me to do my lecture in a shielded room in the Capitol building. Most people don't really know that the top of the Capitol building, the rotunda, is a shielded room that is built there to create a room where it's against eavesdropping by the Russian embassy that is around the corner in Washington.
Right.
So those are expensive things that you build things and you know, to create the right intelligence gathering, it's expensive. So that is my answer, why intuitives and remote viewers are used by so many different countries, because they're relatively inexpensive to activate and work.
Right, right. So you don't get paid to do these tasks?
I would never ask for money for any of these tasks. So you, come on.
So, Yuri, does your, I guess, strongest allegiance lay with Israel ultimately?
Of course, I'm an Israeli, and I love our allies. You know, they help us, and we help them. We are extraordinarily advanced in many different arenas and areas, and you know, than many other countries. And believe me, that if we weren't, there would be suicide bombers blowing themselves up almost weekly in Israel. But we know how to stop them, and that's the problem in the world today: the suicide bombers, because they're radicalized, and you know, they believe in the cause, and they will kill themselves in order to kill others. That's our problem. And I'm all bringing it down. I mean, just look at yesterday, Boko Haram, which is a terrorist organization in Nigeria, killed, I think, 50 children. They just broke into a school and murdered them and, you know, cut them down. It's shocking. What I'm trying to tell you here is probably the final thing that we'll probably end up this interview with. Look, we are worried all intelligence services are in many, many different countries are worried about one thing today. It's nuclear explosion. We are concerned that these radicalized terrorists are not stupid anymore. Some of them go to Yale, Oxford, Cambridge, Stanford University, Penn State, University of Munich, University in China, in Beijing and Shanghai, etc., etc. They're groomed. They're being prepared for something big. There are scientists who work for terrorist organizations, scientists who know about nuclear weapons. We are worried that a nuclear weapon, I'm putting aside Iran now, we are worried that a nuclear weapon will be devised and built and managed to be placed into a suitcase, an attaché case. And just use your imagination, such a bomb exploding downtown Washington or LA or Milan or Rome or London or Paris or anywhere in Tokyo. You're talking about an immediate death toll of 100 to 300,000 people, and then an area of radiation that you won't be able to control for years to come. That is what we are concerned about now, and that's what we have to stop. And those of you out there who are very much into your show, Enric, who are against the National Security Agency, and you are, let's say, with Edward Snowden and all that, that is wrong. We've got to know what's going on. We've got to have information in order to stop major attacks, tragedies, way beyond the World Trade Center.
Now, do you then? No, I hesitate to say think that this will happen. Again, I just want to use it from your point of view in terms of psychic ability. Have you seen anything of this nature happening?
Look,
future-wise?
Why don't you ask this almost like an open question, and like an open letter that everyone can hear and everyone can answer? Show me. By the way, Henrik, where are you based now? Where are you out of?
I'm out of Sweden.
But where? Which city I meant?
I'm close to Gothenburg in Sweden.
Okay. Just go out to the street and ask 20 people in Gothenburg, in the streets of Gothenburg in Sweden, that question. I guarantee you that most of them will say, yeah, it's probably going to happen someday. Almost every American will say that. Nobody is going to say no. Because science is so advanced, nuclear is so advanced today. Look what's happening in many different laboratories around the world. I mean, it's on the internet, for goodness sake. You can build bombs by going to certain websites and learn how to build them. So we are, you know, in an age, day and age, that is scary and dangerous.
There's, of course, a lot more we could ask you. Let me maybe just end on this note before we wrap things up here for this time. There are some pretty bold claims on this program by some guests that we've interviewed about, you know, UFOs and aliens and time travelers and all kinds of stuff, you know. And I wanted to ask you, in your work in the past, did you ever, and you don't have to say what it is, but did you ever encounter anything exotic, shall we say, that you did for any agency or even a private contractor to locate something or find someone or find a base somewhere here or elsewhere, even anything of that nature, or that you did that you could just say yes to, that you did something like that?
Well, my answer to that is no. I have only done very kind of down to earth, logical and rational targets that I was given in the military, you know, in the intelligence arena. But everything you just mentioned, I believe in. There's no doubt in my mind that there are time travelers, no doubt in my mind that UFOs exist, no doubt in my mind that we are being visited. Absolutely. That is in my belief system, and that is a green light. No, I know that phenomenon does exist.
Well, very, very interesting. I think geopolitically we've learned some interesting aspects today as well. And people can, of course, connect the dots for some of the things that you've said, Yuri. And I recommend everyone to, of course, look at the documentary as well that we talked about, because there's some very interesting people in there and things mentioned in there. But yeah, let's wrap things up for this time with you giving up some of the details again, Uri, about your website.
Okay, my website address is urigeller.com, in which you will find the BBC documentary, The Secret Life of Uri Geller, and another documentary that is called Uri Geller, A Life Stranger Than Fiction. Please order the book from Amazon. It's called The Secret Life of Uri Geller. It's written by a brilliant journalist who writes for The Guardian in England and for the Financial Times, and it was actually Time Magazine's European correspondent. I think the book will amaze you. I answer every email I get. Just be patient, and I love you all. Thanks for your patience. I hope I didn't rumble on. If I did, I apologize. And a big hug to all of you. And Henrik, thanks very, very much for inviting me onto your show.
Very good. Thank you for your time, Uri, and for coming on. We do appreciate your time. Have a good day. Interesting regarding 9/11, isn't it? The reaction every time that it comes up. Nope, can't look there. Anyway, I think you can piece together some of the points discussed in this program and to make it relevant in the bigger picture that we are outlining in general on this program. Next up is the strange murder case of Swedish Annie Börjesson, who died in Scotland. We are going to talk with her mother, Guja Börjesson, and with Tommy Nogue, who has been raising legal issues related to this case at the Parliament in Scotland. After this, we have Dane Wigginton on geoengineering, Kevin McDonald, Stephen McNallan, Sophia Smallstorm, Mark Weber, and many more. In the meantime, we say thank you for listening and thank you for being a member. We'll see you on the website, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Follow our news story, subscribe to our RSS feeds, and we'll talk to you in just a few. Have a good one.